You're live.
All right. Hey, folks. Well, thanks for tuning in. Welcome to another broadcast of the Banff podcast. This is Mike Laffer, your host. Here today with a couple of special guests, some freelancers from Wizards of the Coast, Mr. Stephen Townsend. How you doing, Steve?
Pretty good.
Hey, glad to have you back. And Mr. Robert, pronounce your last name for me, please.
Schwab.
Schwab. Thank you. I was sure I was going to murder that. Both of you guys worked on Dungeon Master Guide, and we're here to talk about that today. And Robert, I understand you have a Kickstarter launching this week.
That's right. Shadow of the Demon Lord is my new dark fantasy role-playing game. Kickstarter launches Thursday morning, 10 o'clock Central Standard Time.
Oh, wow. Sweet. And what system is that for?
It is its own system. It's a streamlined, fast-play, low pressure on Game Master and players kind of role-playing game. It's going to have some familiar elements. You'll see some Warhammer Fantasy role-play in its DNA, as well as some D&D, but I think it plays a lot faster and easier than a lot of the games that are out there right now.
Okay, excellent. Now, give us the name one more time, just for a listener who might not have heard it clearly the first time.
Sure, it's Shadow of the Demon Lord.
Shadow of the Demon Lord, and that's launching on Kickstarter, you said, Thursday?
Thursday,
so check it out. Definitely worth your time. Robert, we've had Steve on before, but this is your first time as a guest. Could you give us kind of your brief CV, let people know where you're coming from?
Sure. I guess we'll work backwards. Before I launched Schwab Entertainment, which is a company that's producing my new game, I worked as a contractor for Wizards of the Coast from 2008 until 2014. Is that right? Yeah, about then. And during that time, I worked on supplements for a lot of supplements for 4th edition, and I also was on the design team for 5th edition. And I wrote chunks of Player's Handbook, Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Monster Manual. Before that, I worked as a freelancer for Wizards and also as a line developer for Green Ronin Publishing. Hmm. And I designed a Song of Ice and Fire role-playing. I was a developer for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 2nd Edition. I consulted on Dark Heresy. And it goes back beyond that. But yeah, I've been around for a while.
Wow. So what's been your favorite gig in the RPG industry so far?
I think, you know, probably with I would say being a member of the 5th edition design team was really the high watermark. But my most fun I had was working on Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. I love that game.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, I know Warhammer fans tend to be diehards. So, all right, cool. Good to know. All right, well, hey, and Steve, just to refresh our previous listeners, it's been a couple months since you've been on. Could you catch them up on your background?
Sure. I'm a lot more recent to the industry than Rob. I started out acting and doing improv in Chicago for my 20s, and then I started writing short fiction in my 30s and gravitated into writing for D&D, which was something that I'd always wanted to do. Came on in early 4th edition and then wrote through that, and then, you know, that bled into work on 5th in the Monster Manual and an unexpected part of the DMG. And I've worked for a couple other companies as well. I've worked for Paizo and Sasquatch and a little for Pelgrane, and depending on Rob's Kickstarter, maybe doing a little portion for Shadow of the Demon Lord as well.
Alright. Cool. You know what? Sometimes we forget these things toward the end of the podcast, and I'm sure we'll be talking about the DMG, you know, in some depth. Can you guys give us the elevator pitch for the Kickstarter? You know, what's the setting? Why should people be excited about it? You know, what's the big hook?
One of the things about the game, setting-wise, is that I've looked at 30 years of playing role-playing games, and one of the things I kept noticing was that my groups would fall apart 2 months into the campaign. So, and usually those campaigns pointed towards some big signature cataclysmic apocalyptic event that kind of wraps the whole thing up. So rather than delay that kind of experience, it drags that forward, so you're stomping around in the end times of your fantasy world. That cosmic threat is the Demon Lord, and it's his shadow that's falling on the world that's causing whatever you want it to be. The nature of the apocalypse is something that can change as you decide in the beginning of the game, or it can change while you're playing. One of those kind of, and so it could be a zombie apocalypse, a global pandemic, corrupted magic a la Wheel of Time, a demonic invasion, and so on. That's kind of the thing. And there, mechanically, it's there's a lot more in depth I could go into that, but setting wise, that's the shtick.
Okay. So instead of doing a slow burn, building towards the apocalypse, kind of like, boom, episode one, the world's ending.
Yep.
All right, cool.
Character creation is a blast.
Really? Tell me about it.
The character creation is all about trying to get, well, so character creation is really to get you playing as quickly as possible. When you make your first character, you're making one real big choice. And then you play through the first adventure to kind of figure out how your character is going to develop. So every time you complete an adventure, which are playable in one night or one session, your group gains a level. And at certain levels, you make a big decision about your character. So at level one, when your group hits level one, you choose your novice path. And you make that decision based on kind of what you've done previously. So if you spend a lot of your time fighting with a sword or loosing arrows from your bow, you might choose warrior. If you snuck around a lot, you stole stuff, you might choose rogue. If you found this really scary tome wrapped in barbed wire and human skin and you cast a spell from it, you might choose a magician. And so you stomp around for a couple levels there, then you make another choice. And that other choice can either reinforce or kind of build out your previous choice or take you in a completely different direction. And then again, at level 7, you make your third and final choice, which is your master path. So what that means is that if you start off as a human, and your first game you play is very Call of Cthulhu as far as lethality. You play that first game, and you decide, well, I'm going to be a warrior. At level 3, after playing two adventures as a warrior, you found that you were casting a lot of spells that you found, so you might go into something like mage. And then at the very end, you may have come across this this diabolical statue that's possessed by a demon, and it's whispering to you when you sleep at night, and you've grown an extra mouth under your armpit, and it's also talking to you, and all sorts of crazy stuff's happening to your character. You might decide, you know, I'm going to make a pact with some sort of dark figure and become either a witch doctor or a diabolist or something along those lines. And so it basically allows you to, as you're playing the game, you're constantly creating your character. You're making decisions about your character and what your character does, and those decisions evolve naturally out of the story you're telling.
So
from the way it sounds, I'm hearing a lot of Warhammer Fantasy and like Dark Heresy paths, but instead of choosing them ahead of time, it sounds like you're choosing them during play. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I was thinking about how I love the process of character creation in Shadow of the Demon Lord is how when a lot of times you get together with a bunch of friends to play D&D or play an RPG, and people kind of hem and haw about, you know, like, well, should I play this character? Should I play that character? What do I want to do? What are you going to be? You can make your choices through Shadow of the Demon Lord one by one, but it also allows you to take a bunch of dice and throw them on the table, and then just begin to take take option after option that are all story options. It's not like you're grabbing, like you're trying to put mechanics together. It's like, oh, I was born in a cloister, and so I have a little bit of religious background, but here I have a little bit of mining. So how does that work together with my background in the cloister? Oh, I was a slave at one point, you know, and you're putting all these little things together with your class abilities, and for me anyway, it's fun to say, well, how do these things work together? And in one of the games that I played with Rob, I was like, oh, well, I was an orphan, you know, who was brought up in slavery, and then I ended up in the church, but I'd worked in the mines for a long time before that, and then I got this religious education, and it layered this awesome backstory that I had within actually like maybe 10 minutes of just, you know, it could take, less time than that, but we were getting to know, you know, we were looking through a playtest document. Unfortunately, that character is no longer with us, having been eaten by cannibals in a cave below. But I will remember his story.
It was a good story. Yeah.
You know, that was wearing out a 44-year right now.
The interesting thing about the way characters you put together characters is that the expectations that you're going to be throwing dice to randomly take all these elements together and then jumble, and you can obviously swap out elements, but it has been probably the most powerful tool that I've had that people were, or the aspect of the game that people react to the most strongly. They love it because they don't have to come up with that kind of, I'm going to play the same cookie cutter character I've always played. I'm going to test myself to see, you know, what I might do something different. And also, like Traveler, it is possible for your character to die during character creation. It is possible.
Nice. And, that's old school. That's old school.
And in improvisation, you know, like the reason why, like an improv show, people take a suggestion at the beginning of the show is to unburden the performers from that onus of creating some kind of brilliant thing at the beginning. If you start, you know, the beginning of a show and someone says, Ming Dynasty or something like that, that's going to be a different show than if you had nothing. And you through like Shadow of the Demon Lord, you're taking all these suggestions and you're justifying what they mean. Like in an improv show, you're getting these suggestions and you're breaking them down and figuring out what they mean. So there's a lot of justification in what you do step by step.
Yeah.
Wow, that sounds really cool. Okay, so that Kickstarter starts on Thursday, and wow, you guys got me really excited just talking about it. It sounds like this is kind of a cure for a lot of the problems I've seen in the the classic long-running fantasy campaign. So,
interesting. When I was in college, my limit was 4.5 months. You know, I couldn't get a game to last longer than 4.5 months. And you're right. We're feeling more and more pressure. It's harder and harder to get people together. There's so many things that pull your games apart. So the 2 months kind of strikes a nice balance between everything's a one-shot and an ongoing campaign. So when people ask, well, I want to play in your new game. And the first question is, how long is it going to go? So they know if they're in forever or in for a short time. Yeah.
Right. I mean, one of the groups of people I designed this game for were people I drink beer with at my bar. They're gamers. They want to be gamers, but and I give them a sales pitch. It's like, hey, I've got this really fantastic idea for a campaign. It's going to take us about 2.5 years to get there, and their eyes just glaze. Right. And the other thing I also found, this is direct data coming from polling when I was working on D&D. Average campaign length is like 2 to 3 months, and they fall apart. So if that's true, why would it felt to me ridiculous to create a game with an expectation that would go any longer than that, because I want you to be able to play the full game experience in the time that you have to play it, which is why it's 11 game sessions that are 4 hours long and you're out.
Go ahead, Jason. No, I was saying, I really love this idea.
You were going to speak over each other all night long. Please go on.
No, I had a buddy back in Indiana who was kind of like Charlie Brown with Kiting Tree. He's been trying to run a D&D game to epic levels for like a decade now, and it always peters out, you know, somewhere in the mid-ranks. And it's just really got him really depressed how he can't get a group to stay together for, you know, the 18 to 24 months it takes to really get to godlike levels. And I keep telling him, you know, you're killing yourself for no good reason. I mean, no one does that anymore. But it sounds like you guys are kind of cutting the Gordian knot and really find a way to get to the fun stuff he wants to get to, you know, quickly without all the hassle. So, anyway, that was my thought. Jason, go on.
Well, when I played 4th edition, when it first came out, 4th edition, we started when the only book out was the Player's Handbook. And we met every week pretty much, and we got up to level 24 over about 2 years of play. And now, you know, there wasn't a lot of adventures in the DMG 3, which we were sort of waiting for, never came out. You know, and that there was, but there was a reason to not support it because very few people played that high level. And at that level, the players, their eyes were kind of glazing over because 4th edition kind of turned into Math Club at very high level. So we set it aside for the game. But that was really rare. And I play a lot of Ars Magica, which is one of those games that can take forever. Like, you can spend 10 years on Ars Magica. But then, like, 3 months ago, one of our players ran a 5-session Ars Magica game that's like its own little people that didn't even have any magical powers and all live in this little village in Scotland, and we played it for 5 weeks, and it was awesome. And it was just great to have a limited run kind of expectation. It was nice.
Yeah, it's interesting with the 4th edition your anecdote about 4th edition, because the expectation of 4th edition was that every fight takes an hour, typically, on average. And you have to go through 10 fights per level, if I remember right?
14.
So that's 10 hours of gameplay per level, and there are 30 levels in the game.
Yeah.
That's a lot of gaming, right? That's a lot more hours than you'd put in a video game. And what was interesting for me was that when I was doing supplements for an early 4th, we're just pooping out endless supplements, right? Martial power, divine power, arcane power, and all that stuff were coming out. And it was coming at such a rate that people were still futzing around in the heroic tier, and, you know, were drowning in options for stuff that they, you know, would never get to.
Yeah. Well, listen, so this sounds like a segue. Can we segue to the DMG?
Please.
Okay. Well, first, what an incredible honor it must have been just to work on this damn book.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
I was honored in retrospect, because I wasn't like one of the guys working on it at the time. Kind of, but not really. I wrote the stuff that was in the DMG before the DMG was being worked on, but I didn't know that that stuff was going to end up in it.
What was it, all the Outer Plane stuff?
No, I had a section on campaign events, about 8 pages.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah. I'm running a 5th edition game right now and making up a world and making up adventures, so I've been flipping through those pages a lot. Robert, can you tell us about the process of how the DMG was kind of put together and how it was assembled? And
you know, it was the DMG was one of those books that we were kind of working on in the background from the very start. I mean, when I look back on that experience, we weren't working on one book at a time so much as we were kind of working on all three at the same time.
Yeah.
So one week I might be working on like the barbarian class and then be working on monsters and then be churning out magic items or whatever. When we went to the final stages of kind of nailing down what was going to be in the books, and this is pretty much after Bruce left the company. We're kind of just nailing down the rest of the shape the books would take. The Dungeon Master's Guide was kind of like an orphan dude, an orphan boy. We didn't really want it. It ended up that way because there was so much focus on the player fronted stuff. And Monster Manual took a lot of was also a big hefty tome to get through as well. But what we had when we started it was we had James Wyatt who came in and did a lot of the he kind of sketched out. He actually built the outline. And with discussions with Jeremy Crawford and Merles, basically started putting the book together. And the sections I was responsible for were the magic items section, which I think I did almost all of those. What else? I also helped out with Rodney and I did a lot of the work on the downtime stuff with when you're crafting and training and all that good stuff. I worked with James closely on the planar cosmology entries. Some of the new races stuff, I think. I'm not even sure if that even made it in. But it wasn't one of those things where we're going to sit down and we're going to start with page one and work our way through to the end. Sure. But it was more of just we're cobbling together the bits that we had been working on from the very start and, you know, sanding down the rough spots and rebuilding the stuff that doesn't work and nailing down the format the magic items would take and stuff like that.
Can you give us an example of one of those things that didn't work?
For the DMG or for 5th edition in general?
For the DMG, presumably, but it doesn't matter.
So there was at one point we had, I think actually Mike released the mass combat rules that as a free download in the Oath Arcana.
Yep.
Originally, those rules were in the book, or at least in the draft, in the Dungeon Master's Guide section, for a year or longer, or some version of them. We'd always planned on putting a mass combat system in the game. And I think that was one of those things where we had to come back to it and look at it and massage it, and it just didn't. I mean, you'll see there are rules for siege weapons, for example, in the Dungeon Master's Guide. But I remember going in and putting in rules for naval combat to kind of bolt on to the army's battle system rules.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things that that took more time to get nailed down and didn't quite fit, probably because of page count. Yeah, so that was one of the ones.
You mentioned the magic items, and you said you wrote most of those.
Yeah, well, I think I did. It sure felt like it, because it seemed like I know Rodney did some, and I know Bruce did some, but I paged back through the book today, and I was like, yeah, I did that one, and that one, and that one, and that one.
It's the very first edition list of magic items.
Yeah, it is.
Can you tell me about that decision?
Yeah, well, one of the early on, we had decided that we wanted, you know, one of the kind of the goals that we had in this game was if anything had appeared in D&D, we had at least consider it to go into the game. And my goal was to kind of drag D&D screaming and kicking back to first edition and get that first edition vibe back in the game. So the initial list we made were all a bunch of first edition items. Later on, Rodney Thompson assembled this incredible spreadsheet, which accounted for every magic item that had appeared in the Dungeon Master's Guide, the Unearthed Arcana, and it showed up where they appeared later on. So we started with those lists first, and then gradually filled in with iconic items that came out from other editions. And we prioritized them from 1 to 4, and stuff that were extremely iconic to D&D, and then 4 were stuff that, you know, I'd like to put in, but we just can't. And some of those things we ended up getting in the book anyway.
You say that, well, I keep going on here. Please interrupt me.
No, you seem to have a good handle on it. Go for it.
Rob, so you described that you were kind of dragging D&D, kicking and screaming, back to first edition. This is I'm quoting. So
I wasn't alone.
What's that?
But I wasn't alone in the dragging and kicking and screaming.
Yeah, right.
The team was focused on getting back to its roots.
So why did that need to happen? Like, why was that? Why did it feel? Was it only because I know a lot of fans would say that. Maybe they felt like 4th edition had, I guess, gone off the rails or something. But you're not talking about going back to 3rd. You're talking about going back to 1st. Why that decision?
I think there are a lot of reasons. And, you know, one, I would say the most obvious one is designer bias.
Okay.
And I think of all the editions of D&D, the two I favor the most are the Rules Cyclopedia and 1st edition AD&D. The one I like to play the most is 2nd edition AD&D. But and I think that what had happened was 3rd edition and 4th edition, I think, are both fantastic games. They do what they do very, very well. But I think it's easy to become, I think it's, they, in some to some extent, obscure what the core, or at least what drag would caught a lot of us up in D&D in the very first place, which is about telling stories. That's one of the reasons why you'll see feats relegated to an optional system rather than being an integral part of the game.
Yep.
One of the reasons why you don't see prestige classes anymore. And that's all driven by this idea that we want to lower the barrier to entry. We don't want to have huge stacks of books that you have to climb on top of to make your character. And we want the play experience to be quick and easy. And so to get back to understanding what the root of D&D was, Wizards, their design, their R&D department, worked on, they actually play tested or played through every edition of D&D from White Box all the way up through 4th edition. And they played a full adventure of every one of those editions and extracted all sorts of fantastic, useful information, but just putting fresh eyes on these older versions of the game.
Yep.
And, you know, the thing was is that the most resonant experiences were the ones that harken back to the older editions. I mean, I would put it to you this way. I mean, when you think about playing a D&D game you played in the past, there are two type of things happen when you're recounting these stories. The ones that get you really excited, I would argue, are the ones that are more story-based or exploration-based or more event-based. For example, we don't talk about, do you remember that time that I rolled a 19 when I was attacking that red dragon and I had that feat that gave me a +2 bonus because I was standing on the lee side of a mountain in a thunderstorm? No one says that. But what they do say is, do you remember that time when John's character, like a dumbass, touched the sphere of annihilation inside of the green demon mouth at the end of that passageway? Or do you remember what happens when we put together the two pieces, the Rod of Seven Parts together, and they flew apart, and we had to travel 400 miles to find the other piece again? You know, those are the kind of stories we talk about, because those, that's what this game's all about, telling stories. And so a lot of the, a lot of what we were doing was trying to shake off some of the video game, not really, that sounds, that's not true. Shake off some of the design decisions that had slowly crept into the game and kind of take it back more towards its loosey-goosey, not necessarily not mechanically rigorous, because 5th edition is extremely rigorous, but take the focus off of putting together the character and put the focus more on being an ensemble cast of characters telling cool stories and slaying monsters and getting treasure and doing the stuff that we used to do. It was a long-winded answer.
You've told that story about rolling a 19 on the lee side of the mountain more than once, haven't you?
Probably.
I'm a teacher, and I can tell. I can tell. And just for the record, that observation that you corrected yourself on about the sort of video game terminology of D&D, I'm totally with you on that. That always seemed like a very strange accusation.
Yeah, I mean, the D&D, every edition of D&D is a reaction to the one that came before. And it is usually the design, and you can always see where, even in 4th edition, where it's such a radical departure from 3rd edition, you can see all the various design decisions that went into those games in isolation, and they all make sense. Every one of them makes sense, right? We want we want skills to work this way because we don't have to keep track of skill.
We want fighters to be balanced against wizards, so let's give everybody balance.
And you know, then in isolation they all work, but when you take them together, then you get some sort of problems. And the same thing goes with 3rd edition. I mean, I love 3rd edition, and I wouldn't have gotten into this business if it wasn't for 3rd edition. Right. But you know, there are a lot of things that came out of 3rd edition, which the kind of subscription model of the supplement of supplements, right, where every month you're adding more content to your game. It becomes hard when your game starts groaning under the weight of the extra content. It's really, really hard to be able to run a game in that edition.
Now, how much did you guys have to dig into the older editions to start refining where you wanted to go with not only the DMG, but also the game in general? Because that's one of the things that I hear all the time, is that it's 5e has that real first edition feel with a little more of the second edition flavor. How much did you guys have to delve into the old school in order to kind of get a guide of where you were going?
We went all the way. As I said, nothing was off the table. I remember a conversation I had with two of the members of the design team at Gen Con years and years ago. Well, not years and years, but it seems like years and years ago. And, you know, the idea was that I put forward, I was like, you know, I think we should be able to build a game that says, if you want to play first edition, you can play first edition with these rules. If you want to play third edition, you can play third edition using these rules with these plugins. And that was the kind of idea that we wanted to have, this whole kind of all-encompassing edition of D&D. But in order to make that happen, we had to figure out what each one of those adds to the game. So I think 4th edition, you would argue, adds tactical combat. It adds more class parity, but if you can do that in the core, you don't need to worry about that so much on the back end as a plug-in. With using 1st edition, and I would argue 2nd edition, because they're basically the same game, when using those as the core engine, and then you're layering on top of that to make 3rd edition, to make 4th edition, and to make, you know, theoretically some other version of D&D, that had to be the starting point. So I remember we had drafts of an assassin class, we had a draft of a scion class, we had, if it appears a class in the game or appears a race in the game, there were drafts of it during the design process. So we totally dug into 1st. That was really the kind of the tone and mood of the game I personally wanted to create.
Now, you guys had talked earlier about story progression, and I know Steven had started mentioning about how exciting it is with Shadow of the Demon Lord that you can craft on the fly and stuff like that. With the DMG and D&D 5e, it seems like you have that D&D experience that you can get that has kind of come up in the last 5 to 10 years, where D&D has that certain flavor to it. Can you get games like Song of Ice and Fire, or where it's, you know, basically just humans, or can you get that all orc campaign, or, you know, all kobold campaign if you really wanted something like that? I mean, can you, does the DMG give you rules for crafting that custom experience where you don't have dragon men?
Do you want to take that one, Steve?
I'll start it. My take on it is, well, first of all, I think that you've always been able to do that with D&D. It's just a lot easier. It's again, a lot easier to do it. And it's I would say that it's not by rules that are included, but by rules that are excluded. The system is there aren't rules preventing you from doing those things. And throughout the DMG is all about encouragement, saying, you know, if you go through the DMG, you'll find just copious places where it just says, you know, this is your campaign. Do this. Try this. Try this. Do you want to do a horror thing? Do this. Do you want lasers? Here's lasers. Here's a picture of a woman flying in a jetpack shooting a laser at an Odiug. I mean, that's in the Dungeon Master's Guide. You know, like, the Dungeon Master's Guide for this edition of the game is very permissive. I guess that in the old days, like in first and second edition, it was permissive as well, but it was kind of assumed more or less that you were going to play in a, you know, in a more traditional fantasy setting. But then all the modules that were released, like Barrier Peaks, and, you know, it showed you that you could do anything with D&D. So back when we were growing up, we always felt like we could, you know, like the sky was the limit. I feel like there was a period there where because of the number of rules that we had to do everything by the rules, or people wanted rules for them. And now, by taking the hands off those rules and the rules being specifically permissive, I feel like, you know, again, the sky's the limit, and it's encouraged to be the limit. Most of my games are all human. Just because I say to people when they start, I say, look, if you want to play another race, that's fine, but please justify why you want to do it and what you want to bring to it. Just because I, you know, in the first game we had a dragonborn character, but it worked within the setting that we were doing, and it was very, you know, special and very specific as to why she was. But, you know, I want, if I'm playing a story game, I really want to just know why those characters of other races are there. I don't want people to just be like an elf, or just be an orc. I want to know what they, you know, how they're different than a normal human, and what kind of different energy they're going to bring, or what kind, if they're really going to play that character. You know, that's just one of my little peccadillos.
Well, yeah. I definitely noticed these things that were missing that you're talking about. That you're talking about, Steven. I remember I'm making up a setting, and I'm sort of doing this with Mike as the idea of a setting that we might publish and put 5th edition stuff out in. And so he was like, well, do you want to make it up? And I'm like, well, I need to wait until the DM's guide comes out so I can see the demographics. You remember in 3rd edition where we had all that stuff about how common first level fighters are and what the average level was and how many halflings and, you know, and I was waiting for that to come out so I could see how common are wizards, how common are clerics. And then the book came out and there was none of that shit in it. And I realized, of course, you guys did that on purpose. I mean, you intentionally left all that out so that there isn't any sort of common framework. I can do whatever you want, but I was totally looking for those pages.
I think that what sets the 5th edition D&G apart from other iterations, and this is not a slight against other iterations, I think the 3rd edition D&G may be one of the best books ever made, and the 4th edition one taught a lot of people how to be a good dungeon master. But I think that the 5th edition one realized that at some point you just have to trust your audience. Role-playing games, especially big box games like D&D, and I call it weird to call it a big box game, but anyway, especially games like D&D, are unique products that the designers or the creators of those products have no control over the user experience. If I kick on Guild Wars 2 or Diablo 3 or whatever, I know exactly what my gameplay. The designers know exactly what I'm going to be doing, basically, right? Because they construct everything that I'm doing. But with a game like D&D, it's open ended, and I think that in previous incarnations of the edition, it has been very much to insulate against crappy play, to make sure that you have a McDonald's gameplay experience, so that everywhere in the world can at the very least expect to play a mediocre, crappy RPG experience.
Yes.
If you can have that foundation in place and you get above that foundation, fantastic. But if that mediocre, boring gameplay experience that everyone knows how to play the rules is in place, everything's fine. And I think with 5th edition, especially with the Dungeon Master's Guide, it just says, screw that. You're going to have bad. There are going to be bad games out there. There are going to be people who have no business being a Dungeon Master or trying to run a game. But they're going to figure it out like we did. Because, you know, the 1st edition Dungeon Master's Guide is a wonderful, wonderful book. But you almost have to have a degree to get through that book to figure out where everything's at. I mean, have you ever tried using the pummeling rules? Or open area? Right? You know, it's like, come on, really? And I adore that book, but it's also one that is, you know, it expected that the Dungeon Masters would figure it out. And I think that is it's an empowering thing, I think, for D&D players to be able to have that, to have a product that says, no, the Dungeon Master's Guide is not here to teach you to be a Dungeon Master. It's here to give you the tools to be a good Dungeon Master.
So you're taking the safety net away.
Yeah.
And I think that's what... That bland, mediocre experience, and I'm going to try and phrase it a little bit more nicely. But yeah, this take the safety net away. And
if you want a basic dungeon crawl experience, there are games that do that very well without having to dress them up as Dungeons and Dragons. You can play Descent, you can play Castle Ravenloft, you can play the Dungeon Board Game, you can play whatever you want, right? And they all deliver the same kind of vanilla gameplay experience where we have 10 encounters to gain a level and killed so many number of monsters and rinse and repeat. And I think once you kind of shake that off and you realize a Dungeon Master / Game Master gets to make it up as he goes along, because that's what you're doing, is you're using the rules to help you tell stories, that creates a whole new gameplay experience. Not really a whole new, it's actually just going back to the way we used to do it.
Right.
You know, and as for, you know, some of that story stuff, Greg Bilsland at the end of the process asked for books and references that people like to use, books on mythology, books on story, books on map making, and I was like, well, they're going to ignore everything that I say because nobody really wants to hear about the books I read because they're not the typical books that you'd put in the end of a bibliography for the DMG, and so I, you know, put stuff on the list like Writing Fiction by Janet Burway, which I think is a fantastic fiction textbook. Save the Cat by Blake Snyder, who it's a screenwriting book, and one of the things there are a lot of great concepts in there that have been really helpful to me. Like he'll say, you know, for your concept, for your pitch, make it something a caveman can understand. Because a lot of times you know, people get carried away with making all these convoluted stories. So I made this big list of, like, you know, writing and storybooks, and I just was like, well, this is, you know, just my opinion, and I sent this big list to him, and then, like, most of those books are in the bibliography to the DMG. So what I'm saying is that, like, you know, Rob was saying that you can have this vanilla dungeon experience, but this DMG is saying, you know, you want to do story, well, here's story, and here are references for story. Do you want to learn more about story? Read Writing Fiction by Janet Burway. Read about narration, you know, read about character, read about setting and how that's used. Because, you know, the elements of fiction are how we learn to tell these stories. You know, read the screenwriting book that tells you, you know, how to make action happen, you know, in a tight structure. I love that. I was surprised to see that those books ended up on the list, and very pleased because, you know, I hope that people read them and become better writers and better storytellers. Like you were saying, you know, people will figure it out eventually. You know, even people who are bad DMs, they can go and find... I was a bad DM at one point. I was a terrible railroading... You know, don't go off. You know, you can't go beyond this area. DM at one point, and you know, through persistence and just trying to be a better DM and trying to learn this stuff, I think anybody can do it.
So before the podcast started, we were talking a little bit, and one of the concerns or anxieties that D&D players have right now is we're wondering, where is all the support? Now, I realize that for those of us that remember first and second edition, we're used to like three books being the entire game for a year, you know, or two. So we're used to that. But I think third and fourth edition kind of spoiled us, and we got used to this idea of a new book coming out every month. Like, that was what our disposable income went to every month. And especially when fifth edition is inevitably compared to Pathfinder and other games that are coming out right now, which have just, you know, you walk into the game store and there's an entire wall full of nothing but books for a rival RPG. And I think a lot of people are wondering, kind of, can the game survive? Like, what's the financial plan for a game that comes out with three books and then nothing for 6 months?
So I would argue, if you buy a box of Monopoly, and you play Monopoly over and over and over again. I'm using Monopoly not on purpose. I'm using it because it's unrecognizable, not because it's a good game. But you play Monopoly, and you've got your play experience. You know what you're getting out of it, and you're good to go. You don't buy there's not an expansion for Monopoly. There's no right. So I mean, it's not like you. So that expectation's not there. I don't know why it became necessary. This is my bias. My opinion. But I don't know why. I don't understand why people where we got to the point when the expectation was that you needed two 160-page source books full of new mechanics that you're going to bolt onto a game that you probably only play twice to four times a month.
Yeah.
I think that the point is the point I'm trying to get to is that that is actually pornography rather than actual gameplay material. Because it's not stuff that you're actually going to use at the table. It's stuff that you're using when you're playing the game in your head. You're not actually engaging anybody else to play with this material. You're just playing with it yourself. And that's okay. That's a great game experience. If people are looking for new adventures and adventure content like that, one of the benefits of 5th edition is that it's so easy to convert any edition before that to this game, right? I mean, you can run, you really don't have to do anything to run to convert first edition to fifth edition. You just play it out of the book. Use your stat blocks in the monster manual, and you're good to go. I think what I'm trying to put my finger on is that I don't think Wizards of the Coast is interested in getting back into that subscription-based model. I think they want to put out a complete game that's evergreen that says we're not going to create a wall to prevent newcomers to get into the game, that if some kid 5 years from now comes to pick up D&D from the store, he could pick up the starter kit just like everybody else did and jump into the game.
I think Mike Merles has said before that what they found out through 3rd and 4th edition, and especially for some of the shock for people experienced when 4th edition came out, was that most people have the player's handbook. To them, that's D&D. So when the player's handbook expands beyond all these other books, not everybody reads that. Some people who are really into D&D read it, but if you keep the player's handbook as the entry point and as the game of Dungeons and Dragons, then you can play with anybody who comes to play it. Like, even if you look at the PDF that was released today, the Elemental Evil one. If you look at the beginning, it says, this, these options were created for the Elemental Evil campaign, but ask your Dungeon Master if they'll be allowed in that campaign. You know, it doesn't say, like, remember in 4th edition, it was like everything we put out in Dungeon Magazine and Dragon Magazine is going to be part of the system. This is for this campaign. If you want to use it for your other campaigns, you can, but the player's handbook is still, and the DMG and the monster manual are still, that's Dungeons and Dragons. And I think, like Rob was saying, you said pornography. I feel like we're dealing with an addiction. And the thing about addiction is you just sort of have to let it go and learn to live without it. And, you know, I occasionally check into, like, I used to sort of check into EN World and see what was going on, because that's where I find out what's going on most of the time, because it's all consolidated there. But I would make the mistake of going to the forums and just reading rage, you know, and I haven't checked it in a long time, but today, because the
elemental congratulations.
What'd you say?
I said congratulations. Good for you.
I've tuned out my own addiction to looking at gaming sites. But today I looked at it, and I clicked on the player guide, and I was like, you know, oh, what the hell? It's early in the morning, and I've got, you know, I want to procrastinate before I have to work. So I clicked on it, and I saw people. The first thing I saw was in the forums was, you know, what awesome thing happened in your D&D game? And I was like, it's been a while since I've seen a forum thread that was like, what awesome thing happened in your game? And then I scrolled down, I saw a couple other people talking about their own games, and I was like, things are starting to change, because there's not all these rules to debate about and argue about. And then I scrolled down through the Elemental Evil comments, and people were like, oh, these races are kind of cool, and this is kind of neat, and it's free. And I was like, maybe we're heading towards some, you know, some paradise of D&D where we can all get along and have fun and play games together. Maybe that's happening.
I feel kind of bad about the whole pornography comment, but I really do. But I do know. During my stint in fourth edition, watched some of my players who were very, very eager about. They would just build characters for fun. And I think that's okay. And I think that's, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. That's a great play experience, but it's one, and I guess that's really what I was trying to aim to point at, is that, or at least I kind of look at, was that, you know, D&D is a social game. And if it's going to be a social game, the rules need to facilitate social play. So it's not so much about, I've just built the Uber character, rather it's about, I made a character that works really well with the rest of my group, so we can all succeed together.
Yeah.
I feel like also, you know, when we didn't have, I think, like, board games also in the last 15 years have become a thing. They've become a big thing. You can see in my lovely shelf over here, board games.
Very
impressive. Board games, thank you. Board games do, they can do rules better than an RPG experience can. You know, like, if you're going to play, like Rob was talking about playing Descent. Like, if you want a quintessential, like, dungeon delving experience, Descent can do that really well. And, you know, like, when you're playing a board game and you have a lot of, it's a structured type of play that gives you an experience that works within the framework of that rules. And an RPG needs to be a more open experience, so that, you know, because an RPG is a story and it's about characters. And if you want to play an RPG that has really good and cohesive rules to it, computer games do that probably better than pen and paper games do. You know what I mean? So, like, the nature of the RPG is like, it's a storytelling game. It's a campfire game. It's us getting together and finding out what happens type of game. Because, like, you know, electronic games and board games can do those rules better. They can give you that rules experience better.
Yeah.
Now we're coming up on. Oh, I'm sorry, Jason. Go ahead.
No, please, Rob. Go ahead.
We're coming up on the 1 hour mark, so we're going to start winding this down. But is there something that you guys feel? Really says fifth edition that ended up in the DMG? Is there a specific section of it that portrays the look and feel of fifth edition?
I would say that aside from all the stuff, actually, let me back up. The thing that I think that says fifth edition more than anything else is the embracing the multiverse. Okay. It's that, and I think what that does for this game is it blows up the expectation that there is one right way to play D&D. Yeah. And it's super inclusive for any kind of campaign setting, any kind of world. It allows you to smush all those things together and do whatever you want to do, which I think was, for me, the strength of second edition. and it kind of and it says, you know, that second edition had it right, and we were wrong to let that go. We're bringing it back, and that's the way this is going to be. And I think that's it's just basically this kind of wide open, do whatever the hell you want approach.
Steven?
I would echo that answer. I would say that the picture of the lady with the jetpack shooting the Odiog with a laser is pretty much just says to me that the D&D can be anything you want. And the permissive nature of the DMG throughout the book, also all the charts and tables. You know, those are we were talking about suggestions earlier, and you know, getting things to generate ideas for adventures and for situations. DMG is full of that. It feels like the first edition DMG, but without, you know, without the needing that degree to sort of sort through it, as Rob was saying.
Yeah. Jason, final thoughts or questions before we call it a podcast?
I just want to thank you guys so much for coming down. It's a real honor to talk to you both, and I love the DM's guide. I'm running the game. My players are loving it. We're doing this sort of Solomon Kane colonial era horror campaign where ordinary people are turned into monsters by a cursed rain from the sky, and it's just awesome. I mean, it's the kind of game that you couldn't really do in 4th edition. 3rd edition had openings for, but didn't really encourage. I have to make up everything as I go, but you know what, that's why I'm playing the game, right? I mean, if I didn't want to make it up as I go, we'd all be playing Elder Scrolls Online or something. Anyway, I just wanted to really thank you because I think you guys did a hell of a job, and I just really love it.
Well, thank you very much for having us, and this Dungeon Master's Guide owes a lot to a lot of people, and I would be remiss if we didn't give shout-outs to James Wyatt, Jeremy Crawford, Rodney Thompson, and all the other folks who put their blood, sweat, and tears in that book, because I think this was of the three books that came out for 5th edition, the Dungeon Master's Guide is by far my favorite.
Yeah.
And Robert, where can people stalk you on the internet if they're looking to connect or find your products?
Oh yeah.
Why don't you give a final shout out for Shadow of the Demon Lord as well?
I'd love to. You can find all the information about Shadow the Demon Lord on schwalbentertainment.com. That's S-E-H-W-A-L-B entertainment.com. You can become my new best friend on Facebook as Robert J. Schwalb. You can follow me on Twitter at R.J. Schwalb. If you're more interested to my professional company side, like my Facebook page, Schwalb Entertainment LLC, or you know, follow my other Twitter thing, which is Schwalb_Ent. But basically, Facebook is a place to find me, and I'm usually there. Also on Google Plus and everywhere else. But Kickstarter goes live on Thursday. It's going to be a terrifying, mad experience full of demons and lords and shadows and blood and guts.
Oh my God, Robert, if I ever start a car dealership, you are so coming to work for me. Steven, where can people stalk you on the internet?
I'm the Townsend on Twitter. I have a inactive blog called Steve's Gamer Blog that I don't really post to anymore. and I usually use the handle Dramatics wherever I am. So that's usually where I am. But the Townsend on Twitter, you can find me there if I ever poke my head up. As you can tell by this podcast, I'm really bad at like 140 characters.
You and me,
well,
together,
gosh.
We'll broadcast this far and wide, and that way we'll get some people to harass you to post more. Jason, where can we stalk you on the internet?
Oh, shoot. I'm on Facebook, Jason Tondro, and my blog is drcomics.blogspot.com. And I'm on Twitter too at Dr. Comics, all spelled out, two little words. And that's what I do. So Rob, I'm going to find you on Facebook. I'm going to be your new next best friend.
Hell yeah, I love best friends.
I'm also going to give a quick shout for Mike Lafferty, who had to step away because his son was looking to touch the Sphere of Annihilation in the Green Dragon's mouth. So. So my name is Walt, and that we're going to call a podcast.